What's up, man? It's nice to see you. How's things?
Things are good. How about you?
Oh, so it's I don't think it the irony isn't wasted on me, Randall, that we're going to be talking about the Boston Marathon
Yeah.
today. And I feel like I just ran my own personal Boston Marathon yesterday. But that's a whole different story. We'll get into that in just a minute. Randall, I got a question for you that I didn't prepare you for. You ready?
Yes.
What's the best sports city in America?
I'm gonna probably have to go New York. Though I think there's a lot of options.
I'm gonna say something that I'm gonna regret saying, and it hurts my feelings to have to say it. But after yesterday, Boston's probably the best sports city in the world, and it hurts me to say it.
Really? Why? Why do you think that?
Well, we'll get into that in just a second.
Okay,
Why don't we
okay.
let's get to that in a second. Today, though, folks, we're back. It's Sports Out of Time, Episode 7, Season 1. Today, we are talking about Catherine Switzer and the Boston Marathon. So yesterday, I had to take my students to their senior trip to Boston, and it's the first time I've ever been to Boston proper, like the city of Boston.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
I've been to like Springfield, and I've been to other parts of Massachusetts and Pittsfield, but
Okay.
never really like in the heart of Boston proper, Boston Harbor, and all that good stuff.
Yeah,
And as a
yeah.
history teacher, that's like a big one for me. So I'm almost like, oh,
Yeah.
there's so much stuff that I can do here. But I think it was last night when I was on this boat in Boston Harbor, and the kids were doing like, there's like a dance floor, and there was like catering, and it was on a boat, and they were in the harbor. It was really
Sure.
nice. The kids enjoyed themselves. But, I'm an adult, so I'm just like, I'm just gonna walk around and look at stuff. I'm gonna look at the
Yeah.
skyline from the boat, right? Around Boston Harbor, and you can see the TD Garden where the Celtics are playing currently, or the game is going on as
Oh,
we're,
yeah.
yeah,
Yeah,
right.
absolutely.
And right out front of it, there's like this outdoor event going on where there's like this big blow up TV, and people are watching the TV outside. You can like see it on
Okay.
the boat as you go by. And then as you get to the other side, you can see the lights of Fenway. And it's just like, yeah, they got a good situation set up here, like
Sure.
outside of Foxborough, which feels like it's out in the middle of
Yeah.
nowhere
Yeah.
from everywhere else. Having
Right.
those three teams and those two stadiums in such like tight connection with the rest of the city, that's like a really nice little setup they got over there.
Yeah, it really is. So you've never been to a Red Sox game
Never been to a Red Sox game.
in
That was the one.
Boston.
No. I've seen the Red
Yeah.
Sox in New York, but I've never been
Right,
to a Red
right.
Sox game in
In
Boston.
Fenway Park. And okay, yeah, no. Yeah, Boston is it's pretty special. There's no doubt about it. I mean, when you're asking best sports cities, I think the fans on the East Coast are just so well, fanatical, right? I mean, they really are. mean, that's why they're called fans. So, because you've got Boston, New York, and Philly, which is famously known as a good sports town, but they're pretty rough on their hometown teams. And then once you get, once you go outside of the East, and really the Northeast, well, Philly, let's include Philly there. You get to Chicago, which is a good sports town, but we're really easy on our teams here. You know what I mean? We get cut them a lot of slack because we're used to the losing. And then you go out west, and it's, who knows, right? I mean, people show up at third inning of the Dodgers games and they leave in the seventh. And even the Lakers, who are probably the biggest attraction out in LA.
Yeah, that feels right.
People come in as the game is going, not in the playoffs necessarily, but you know what I mean.
Well, it feels like the Dodgers are on the way up over the last few years. Like, I hear a lot of people, I have some friends out in Los Angeles way, and it seems like that's like a hot ticket to get, is you can get a Dodgers game and go out to to Chavez Ravine or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I actually put up a list later, but I want to save that because I don't want to bury the lead today for what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And that is Catherine Switzer. Randall, you brought this story to me. Let me do a little podcast hosting here. For folks who don't know anything about Catherine Switzer, she is a trailblazer for women and women's sports. Born in 1947, she grew up in an era where women were expected to embrace traditional roles. But she, as a young girl, discovered her passion for running. In 1967, Switzer made history by becoming the first woman to officially run the Boston Marathon and defy widespread prejudice and skepticism. So, Randall, you brought up this story to me.
Yeah.
We might have talked about it when we did the original episode, but just real quick, what stuck out most to you when you brought up this story and your research on it?
Well, the first thing that really stuck out to me is that I had no idea this story existed.
Yep.
And when you and I were talking about doing the podcast and we decided, yeah, let's do it, you know, all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I've got to get some story ideas together. I had a few, right? But I also wanted to find some new ones. And it didn't take me a lot of digging to find this story. Which is why I'm like, I can't believe I don't know this story. I've never heard of this story. Right. And I think you experienced that once we got into it, right. You're like, oh yeah, there's a lot on this story. And I guess to me, 1967 doesn't seem that far away from us. I mean, it is right. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the whole mindset of women and athletics has changed so dramatically since then. And it just seems absurd that's, you know, as we get into in the podcast of what people thought of women in sports, right?
Yeah.
It's crazy. Yeah. I can't believe that.
Well, also keep that in mind, because I'm about to frame 1967 for you. I want to let you know, I had a real hard time finding the actual date of this race. Every time I look up info, it's like 1967. So the best guess I could get was that it was probably around April 17th, 1967, when this race was run. Yeah.
Well, it was Patriots Day. Maybe that would have been the easier thing to find.
Well, there you go. See, whatever Patriots Day was on April.
What, in 1967?
Seven, yeah. Well, I got as close as I could here. So if you were out at the Boston Marathon watching Catherine Switzer run in 1967, you could have capped off your evening with a movie with a night at the cinema, seeing the number one movie in America, Thoroughly Modern Millie, a modern, a musical romantic. This is like up your wife's alley. Yeah, Julie Andrews. Yeah.
A bouncing, bubbling motion picture highlighted by the music of Elmer Bernstein and Andre Previn.
I'm a jazz baby. Little jazz baby, that's me.
The whole panorama of the exciting 20s joyously presented through Millie and her mischief. It couldn't be more delightful, especially with Julie Andrews at her joyous best.
This story follows a naive young woman who finds herself in a series of madcap adventures when she sets her sights on marrying her wealthy boss. some other good names, though. This is a good movie. It's got Mary Tyler Moore is in this. You got Carol Channing. You got, who's this? Gavin. That sounds like a rough and tumble name. Gavin. Yeah. And of course, Julie Andrews, who's good in everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. Magnificent.
What was that movie we watched when we were in Ohio that everyone watched with her? Was it Victor Victoria?
Yeah. Was it? Was that where it was the...
She was in drag doing the singing? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think I'd ever seen that movie before. That's a wild movie.
Yeah. It's a fun one. Yeah, absolutely.
And the way home from the night at the cinema, you could turn on the radio and listen to the number one song in America. It's not the first time it was recorded, but it's the most famous time it's recorded. The 1967 version of Something Stupid by Frank Sinatra and his daughter, Nancy Sinatra.
And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me. Then afterwards we drop into a quiet little place and have a drink or two. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you.
There's always something really unsettling to me when there's like a song that is romantic but is sung by people who are related.
Yeah, it's a little weird. I've seen you do that at a couple of weddings.
Yeah, me and your wife have had a lot of conversations about some of the songs that we've had to sing. It's like, okay, all right, yeah. And then after your drive home, you could settle in the house in a comfy chair, maybe with a nice brandy and a cigar, and settle in to the number one book, well, fictional book, in America in 1967, The Arrangement by Elia Kazan. Now, I didn't know much about this book. It's kind of interesting. It's a narrated by a successful Greek-American advertising executive who's living in Los Angeles, and he suffers a nervous breakdown because of all the stress in his life, right? The arrangement of his life. It got made into a film in 1967. It was a bestseller, and it generated pretty favorable reviews, but it's been out of print since the 1980s. So it's not very easy. Yeah, it's not really easy to find, apparently, anymore, this book.
Elia Kazan. He lives in a world of gifted, ambitious people. People who make it to the top. Kazan wrote a book about this world of success. He called it The Arrangement. That immensely successful novel is now a film by Kazan. The Academy Award winner has made memorable motion pictures in the past, but The Arrangement is unique. Starring Kirk Douglas, Faye Dunaway, Deborah Carr.
The film adaptation, by the way, is from 1969, and it stars Faye Dunaway, Richard Boone, and it stars Kirk Douglas. So you know it must be good. Yeah, Kirk Douglas.
It's got to be good. Got to be good.
So there you are, just a little time capsule of what else was going on around April 17th, I think, 1967. Randall, have you done any running recently? I was thinking about this yesterday.
I have not done any running recently. I stick to walking. I might walk uphill and a hike. That's what I do instead of run. No, I don't. I'm in awe of people who can do long distance running because it's never been for me.
I'll give you a good example. When I ran in high school, it was fine. It was whatever. When I go to the gym and I just walk for like a half an hour, I'll go a little uphill for a half an hour.
Exactly.
And then I'm like, a couple of weeks, like last week or something, I was like, you know what though? I'm going to try and do something different. So I was like, I'm going to do the Stairmaster. I haven't done the Stairmaster in a long time. Yeah, let me get on the Stairmaster. And turns out walking on the treadmill don't do much for some other muscles in your legs, because I did about 30 seconds on the Stairmaster. I was like, oh, this is awful. Because like, it's one of those like automatic treadmill ones, right? Where it's just like,
yeah,
keep walking.
I've seen them. Sure.
Feels like, I don't want to be too harsh, it feels a little like you're in the gulag. It's like, keep walking, walk.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It might be a little harsh for what you're experiencing, yeah, but I get the point.
Yeah. All right. So why don't we,
I wanted to ask you before we get into it. So did you make your kids that you took on the school trip to Boston, did you guys walk the Boston Marathon route to prepare for this episode this week? You didn't.
We didn't, but you know what? I'll save that for the after part, because I got a couple good Boston things
good.
I want to share
Sounds
with you
good.
After this. All right, so why don't we get into this week's episode 7, Season 1, Catherine Switzer and the Boston Marathon.
Here, there you go. Now you can see me. Not that you need to.
Well, you know, it's so funny. I did that podcast that came out last week, and my buddy didn't tell me that he was going to release the video content with it. You know, when we record these, by the way, for you and me, this is also inside baseball for folks listening. I do get the video recordings of these, and you'll know by what I'm wearing, which is just a shirt that just says Italy with an Italian flag on it, that I certainly didn't believe that anyone would be looking at me.
Right.
Yeah, this is not like something I would wear out in public.
No.
I just got back from the gym. Randall, it's nice to hear your voice. We actually haven't talked to each other in a couple weeks with real time. Yeah. Not that people would know that by the time production
exactly.
is over. But how's things? How's life?
Oh, it's good. Good. You know, just been busy. New job.
Yeah, congratulations.
You know, thank you. People visiting. So displacing me from my normal office space. So, yeah, try to find space and keep going.
Keeping it inside baseball, since we are here today to talk about the first woman to run the Boston Marathon, yeah. My thought would be that you came up with this idea because you're surrounded by women, my mother, your mother-in-law included, as you host my whole family this week. Is that why you came up with this idea?
You know, let's say yes. sure. That's how I came up with the idea. It wasn't just a story I stumbled upon. It was, yeah. I searched for it because of all the wonderful women in my life.
That's a smart way to go, because again, I'm sure they'll listen to this. So before we get into today's subject of Catherine Switzer, a couple house cleaning things I want to do very quickly. Number one, I just want to point out that although I'm sure I'll do all the administrative work before production is done, I just want to point out that we are now on Instagram and Twitter at Sports Nice. Out of Time at both. I can't believe those handles existed, so good on that. By the time you hear this, I assume that more will be posted there. At the moment, it's just pictures of like Liverpool and Knicks players, and that's it, right? But by the time this airs, there will be more up there, so please go ahead and follow along. And then also, before we get into our content here, yeah. Randall, with the story sure. you came up with, I wanted to get where you are in terms of running or long distance running, since we are going to be talking about marathon running. What have you done in terms of distance running in your lifetime?
I'll be damned.
Sir, where are you running?
Why are you running?
Are you doing this for world peace?
Are you doing this for the homeless?
Are you running for women's rights?
Or for the environment?
Or for animals?
They just couldn't believe that somebody would do all that running for no particular reason.
Why are you doing this?
I just felt like running.
So I have done zero distance running in my lifetime. And typically anytime I had to do too much running in like a training for a sport, I'll give you an example. In junior high school, so sixth, seventh, eighth grade, I was on the wrestling team. Mm-hmm. And I thought there was too much running for the wrestling team. I wanted to quit. So if there's too much running, I'm usually done. I'm out. Like baseball, that's easy. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yes.
Especially when you're a kid. It's like, you know, you're just running to bases. You get a break.
Baseball and football are two of what I call, like, they're not lazy sports, but right. there's a good portion of those games where you are just doing nothing. Right? Yeah. Like, there's a... Like 60% of the game is just kind of you standing there being
Absolutely.
Ready.
Absolutely.
Being ready.
Yeah. No, I definitely needed a break every now and again. So how about you?
So I'm glad you asked that, because I was one of those kids who loved sports. Even today, I love sports, but I was never good at any sport at all. Every sport I played, baseball, lacrosse. I was okay at lacrosse. Baseball, though, football, basketball, mm-hmm. the sports, the big sports that everyone wanted to play. Awful. Can't throw, can't catch. Uncoordinated, small, not in great shape. Just never really worked out for me in any of these sports. So my sophomore year in high school, I played 1 year of high school football when I went from middle school to high school. And I found out very quickly that I was like, oh no, I'm too small. These guys are way bigger now. I can't do this. So the next year I was like, well, I want to do something. I don't want to do nothing. Right. What can I do that isn't like super competitive? And my buddy Anthony, shout out to Anthony Mons back in the day. He said, why don't you just come run cross country? And I was like, I don't run anywhere. I've never run anywhere. He's like, that doesn't matter.
I can't understand long distance people. They work so much and they run so much. Even their warm up day, they run for this miles upon miles, getting their legs warmed up. And I always ask him, like, how does that make any sense at the start? Like, how can you run the same distance you're about to run on the track? You know what I mean? Just to warm up to get your legs going.
And so I went and ran cross country for 3 years. I ran 3 years of cross country.
Which, to be fair, in high school was easily the best shape I had ever been in my life. Just absolutely. Yeah. Like, which is crazy because you would do this thing where you'd like, okay, I'm going to go eat Taco Bell for lunch. And then three periods later, I'm going to go run 5 miles. And then I'm going to, and it's no big deal. I'm totally cool with it. and I liked it just fine. I never loved it, but I liked it because it kept me in shape. And I was, you know, I was, team was fun. I knew most of the guys. It was chill. That was about it. Now in Utica, where I'm from, we have a race. Are you familiar? Yeah, the Boilermaker.
I am familiar. Right.
Well, the Boilermaker 15K has reached its 8,500 runner capacity. Now the only way to run this race is to sign up for the wait list or check with the Boilermaker charity bib program. If you do want to run the 5K instead, there are still more than 800 spots left. The cap there is 3,500. And a reminder, once you sign up for the race, head to WKTV.com and follow along with the Go the Distance training program that we have here at News Channel 2. And why not join the runners?
That's sort of our local race, the Boilermaker 15K. It has been held every year since, I want to say, 1978. So it's been going on for a long time. For years, I avoided that. Even when I was in cross country, I didn't run it. I ran that five times when I came back from New York City, 5 times in a row. I was like,
did you really?
Yeah, I did it 5 times in a row. And then that was it. Since then, I've quit running. I stopped running. I think in my late 30s, my back and knees have abandoned me. It's just too much recovery if I go running anymore.
Right.
Even today, if I go to the gym, I'm just going to walk on the treadmill for like 35 minutes. I'll go uphill or something. But I abandon it. I can't do it anymore. But I respect what it takes because I know
people
run all the time, and I didn't have it in me for an extended period of time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. In fact, you know, my son, your nephew, is in cross country and runs long distance for track. And yeah, I give him all the credit in the world for doing it because it's something that I would have never done. So it takes a lot.
And I'll say one last thing before I let you start. There's this myth that exists of this thing called the runner's high where you're like running and you're tired and then all of a sudden you kick into the it doesn't exist.
At least you never got there.
Not for me. It never did for me. I just sort of had to drag it out for 9 miles. Like, oh god, every mile's worse than the last. So Randall, I'll let you get started today. Our subject is Catherine Switzer.
Yes, thank you so much, Sam. Yeah, this is a story that I think is really, it's a cool, fun story, but it's also one that kind of, you realize how far we've come in the last, you know, 60 years, 55, 60 years.
Lisa, if the Bible has taught us nothing else, and it hasn't, it's that girls should stick to girl sports, such as hot oil wrestling, foxy boxing, and such and such.
Sure. So in 1967, Catherine Switzer was a 19-year-old journalism student at Syracuse University, right up the road from you, Sam.
Hey-o.
Hey. Catherine was an avid runner, and since Syracuse didn't have a running team for women, mind you, very few schools had a running team for women in this era.
That is correct.
She began to train with the men's cross-country team. That's where she met a 50-year-old named Arnie Briggs. Arnie happened to be the university mailman, and he just trained with the team. And he'd been doing it for like 15 years at the university. And he took Catherine under his wing and would encourage her through her training with stories from previous Boston marathons that he had run. And at this point in time, I think he had run about 15 as well. So while Catherine loved listening to these stories, she finally suggested they stop talking about Boston marathons and just go run the damn thing, right? But Artie didn't think Catherine, or any woman for that matter, could finish a Boston marathon, right?
So, I want to say,
I
just want to say real quick, I went and watched the BBC little coverage on this. It was like a 2-minute interview on this.
Yeah.
And what I find fascinating about Arnie Biggs is while his idea is like no woman could ever run, it feels sexist, but it's interesting in a way because he almost genuinely did not believe that women could physically do it. He's like, no, you don't understand.
The idea of running long distance was always considered, you know, very questionable for women because, you know, an arduous activity would mean that you're going to get big legs and grow a mustache and hair on your chest and your uterus was going to fall out.
Like, women physically do not have the capability. Like, it was a weirdly non-malicious sexism, like it almost like a kind of a duh type situation. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I thought that was fascinating when I watched it.
I think you're right, because obviously reading this story, and as we continue, there are some quotes that probably sound more sexist today than they were intended or were at the time. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. So that's a good point. So Arnie insisted that distance was too long for a fragile woman to run.
That's right.
Catherine kind of pushed back and said that Roberta Gibb had jumped into the race and finished it the previous April. But Arnie insisted that no dame ever ran the Boston Marathon.
Arnie came straight from 1936 with that one.
Exactly. But he did say, if any woman could do it, you could, but you'd have to prove it to me, Arnie. Mm-hmm. So he said, if you ran the distance in practice, I'd be the first to take you to Boston. Mm-hmm. So obviously that was enough to get Catherine interested, right?
Yes.
And a little side note here. So the Roberta Gibb comment. So in 1966, the year before, Roberta Gibb registered for the Boston Marathon, but was denied entry because women weren't allowed to run it at that time. Now, she received a letter from the Boston Marathon that stated, women are not physiologically able to run a marathon.
Physiologically able. Physiologically what a wild quote. Able,
right? Yeah. The Amateur Athletics Union prohibited women from running farther than 1.5 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And the organizers just couldn't take the liability, in quotes, of having her compete. So they wouldn't let her run. But Roberta wasn't going to be deterred by that. So she hid in a bush near the starting line, disguised in a hoodie and her brother's Bermuda shorts, and joined the race from there once it began. And according to Gibbs, she finished the marathon in 3 hours, 21 minutes, and 40 seconds, which would have put her ahead of 2/3 of the male competitors that year. Now, unfortunately, her participation and the race time are completely unofficial.
Alone and unprotected. But I found a little clump of bushes as near to the start as I could get. And I thought, well, I'll just wait until about half the pack goes by and then I'll jump in. Then I waited. I jumped in. The men behind me quickly realized I was a woman. And they said, wow, there's a woman running. I wish my wife would run. I wish my girlfriend would run. The men were really supportive. And a local radio station was broadcasting my progress.
It's pretty crazy, too, to think that this concept, again, not super far away. This is 1967, right? We'll talk about Title IX a little bit later, but it's 1972 when we get to Title IX. Right. So we're still about 6 years away from most of America even thinking about women's sports, even collegiate women's sports, as anything other than like a pipe dream.
Yeah. Which just seems absurd. Yeah. But you're right. It's crazy. So we'll continue with our story. So 3 months before the 1967 marathon, Arnie and Catherine ran their 26-mile trial that Arnie said she had to do. Now, Catherine felt strong towards the end of the trial and suggested running an additional 5-mile loop for a total of 31 miles.
Yeah.
Well, that convinced Arnie. So the next day, he registered him and Catherine for the Boston Marathon. Now, Catherine registered as KV Switzer, which was a common way that she signed her name in the day.
And one of the things I noticed when I was doing my research on this, why they did this, is essentially the Boston Marathon didn't explicitly ban women from running. Correct. There was nothing in the documentation. So if you're a strict constitutionalist about the Boston Marathon rules, you think, well, there's nothing. Yes. It doesn't say women can't sign up. This was very clever. I don't know if this was Arnie Briggs' idea or her idea or if it came put together, but brilliant.
So I filled out the entry form. I sign my name with my initials. I signed KV Switzer. When I signed it that way, obviously, when the form went in, they couldn't tell it from a guy's.
The world's most famous foot race even attracts a leggy lady, Kay Switzer of Syracuse.
So there we were with my coach, Arnie Briggs, and my boyfriend, an All-American football player, Tom Miller. When other runners would come by, they would say, oh, it's a girl. And they were so excited. And Arnie was saying, yep, I've trained her.
So the group would grow to include Catherine's boyfriend, Big Tom Miller, and that's what they called him. He was a 235-pound ex-All-American football player and nationally ranked hammer thrower. And, you know, he decided he didn't need to train because if a girl can run a marathon, I can run a marathon.
Can I just say real quick, so far, Jumping into a race out of a bush while not registering,
yeah,
and also not training for a marathon and just thinking that you can do it are very common methods that my buddies Dano and Adam would use with the Boilermaker. These are regular maneuvers. Dano would just jump in. Adam's like, I don't need to train. Classic. Right. We do this all the time. We can't help
I'm
ourselves.
Good. Let's
We're
just
good.
Do
we just go. It's fine.
Right? Right?
That fettuccine was sitting in my stomach like a rock.
You got nothing to worry about. I put ammonium in Toby's coffee before the race.
Excellent. Simpsons. Wait, ammonium or Excellent?
I'm making great time. Usually I'd have to take a bathroom break halfway through a race like this, but not today.
Oh, Alfredo sauce.
And the last member of this crew was John Leonard, who happened to be a member of the men's cross country team at Syracuse. So
yeah,
he
Syracuse Harriers was the name of their team. I looked that up. Yeah, the Syracuse Harriers, which is not the Orangemen. Always thought that was interesting.
Wow, that is interesting. Interesting.
Sorry.
So that was the crew. They were going to go run the marathon together. So again, in 1967, the Boston Marathon was on Wednesday, April 19th, Patriots Day in the state of Massachusetts, with a noon start time. Now, the weather was freezing rain, sleet, and wind, so I'm sure nobody was looking forward to running 26 miles in that weather.
It's awful to run in terrible weather. It's the worst, dude. It sucks so bad. It's awful.
And as the runners huddled at the starting line, many of them had sweatsuits and hoodies, so you know, really couldn't tell who was who. Catherine wore sweatpants, a sweatshirt, and some gloves. Some of the runners realized that she was a woman when she was lining up to race, and they were quite happy to see her and encouraged her at that point in time.
Yeah.
And she was able to blend in with the crowd, and no race official spotted her at the start. So she was just part of the big group.
I can tell you, at least from my experience, from running in, again, the Boilermaker is not the Boston Marathon. It's only, it's 9 miles, not 26.
Right.
It's long, but it's still, you know, a third of what Ms. Switzer ran here. But I can tell you that the starting section of a long distance race is easily the worst part of it. It is because essentially what happens is you are stuck in this big giant glob of humanity. And
right.
You know, outside of the pole position runners are the people who are obviously going to win this. So they're up at the top and they're getting the preferred
the
numbers.
The serious
runners, right?
Right.
And most races do stagger them out, right? You have to mostly give your time when you're going in. You know, I can run this race in an hour and 20 minutes and they're going to put me up to the front with like all the dudes who came from like Kenya and Germany to come run this.
Sure.
That's a mistake. But a lot of times that first pack is, it's a good time. It's a bit of a party, but it's also a bit of a nightmare. There's so many people. It's a massive humanity, and you really almost got to get about a third of a 0.3, 0.4 miles in before the race actually opens up and you can actually start running.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. You're just packed in and everyone's super jacked and excited.
Super jacked. Yep.
And till, you know, whatever your abilities play out down the road.
Exactly.
So but everything was good at the Boston Marathon in 1967 until about the 4 mile mark in the race.
Yeah.
And at that point, the press bus pulled up in front of this group of four runners that we're speaking about today, Catherine Switzer's group. And the journalists realized there was a woman in the race with actual numbers on, like the bib with numbers. And that was something that they had never seen.
The guys were wonderful. And then suddenly came a beep, beep, beep of the press truck. It had started behind us and they were filming backwards and going up to the front of the race. They were saying, looking at the program and seeing who she was and kept filming me and shouting at me, you know, what are you doing in the race? You know, what are you trying to prove? And I thought, well, that's really strange. And all of a sudden, then alongside of the press bus was another bus that was.
And at this point, you know, they were having a great time. The group was having a great time running the race. Then seemingly out of nowhere, a man with an overcoat and felt hat was in the middle of the road, shaking his finger at Catherine. And he said something as she passed and reached out for her hand, catching her glove instead and pulling off the glove. And everyone did a kind of a stutter step and had to jostle around him. And Catherine thought he was just a nutty spectator. But when they passed, they caught a glimpse of a blue and gold BAA ribbon on his lapel, which was the official's ribbon. Okay?
Yes.
And I know you've looked, Sam.
Yeah,
but if you go on YouTube, you can see this insanity play out, right? You can see pictures of it. It's crazy.
It's an amazing photo that I will certainly post on the Instagram because I found a couple photos of it.
Yeah.
And I have some takes, so I'll let you get through this, but I have a couple of things I thought
that's great. Sure. Yeah. So this man who tore the glove off of Catherine's hand was race official Jock Semple. Now, Jock pursued Catherine after this, after she passed him, and caught up to her, grabbed her shoulder, and pulled her back towards him, and he said, "Get the hell out of my race and give me those numbers." And he swiped at the bib on the front of her sweatshirt, missed, then tried to get the numbers off of her back.
Very, very feisty. Also, the journalists on the bus were teasing him, saying that there's a girl in your race, Jocko. And he lost his temper. He had a short fuse anyway, but he jumped off this bus and ran after me. But I didn't know that because up in front of me was the press truck. Behind me was him, and he ran up behind me, and I heard his shoes at the last minute. He had leather shoes, and you can hear the difference. It's like a runner always hears a dog.
So, one of the things I saw that was fascinating about this is the gentleman here, race official Jock Semple, who it seems is a Scottish gentleman who they referred to as Jocko. Turns out, and again, I don't know if you're going to believe this or not, he was a pretty short-tempered guy outside of this as well, had a pretty short fuse. And what it seemed like had happened is after the press bus had come by and had sort of taken the pictures, "Hey there, Catherine, what are you doing running the race?" And what you got was then the bus of officials. And the officials bus was full of all of Jocko's buddies. And this story had made their way to them. And they had started riding Jocko a little bit like, "Hey there, Jocko, there's a woman in your race there. Lad. Come on, get him," right? So Jocko was getting all upset. And the other thing I thought was fascinating, and this is something that runners might notice, when you run in running shoes, they don't make much of a sound because, again, they're meant for running.
Yeah.
But what Catherine had mentioned in the video I saw is that she could tell someone was running behind her wearing leather shoes because dress shoes make a different sound when they hit the ground. And that's how she sort of knew something was up with whatever was coming behind her, which is a pretty fascinating thing because runners do this all the time. You should be able to tell if it's like a dog or a car, or you're going to be able to hear sound clues behind you, which I thought was a fascinating part of this. And I'll let you go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, sure. No problem. Yeah. So Arnie, her coach, was attempting to push Jock away, explaining that he had trained Catherine, but Jock would hear none of it and told Arnie to stay out of it. And as Jock was holding Catherine's sweatshirt, prohibiting her mobility, Big Tom comes running into Jock with a cross body block, sending Jock flying in the air and landing with a thud. After this, Arnie, full of fear, shouted, "Run like hell."
But he couldn't get the front. And I was trying to get away from him. It was like a bad dream, really. You know, the tigers got you and you can't get away. And then suddenly my boyfriend, who was running alongside, was an ex-All-American football player, weighed 235 pounds, came running and smashed the official with the shoulder charge, sent him flying. And my boy coach, eyes got huge. We all got very scared. Then he said, "Run like hell." And down the street we went. We were flying past that press truck.
Boy, you want to talk about a great picture. Again, I looked at the photo on this. And I'm just going to, I don't know if this reference is going to hit for everybody. This photo looks like Winston Churchill is getting shoulder blocked by Mike Allstott. It is one of the weirdest things I've ever, it is the weirdest combination of people. And I was trying to think about this, right? So I want to say this happened at the 4-minute mark of the race.
I think they said about the four mile mark.
So the 4 mile mark, 4 mile mark of the race.
So what not far in.
No. And what I saw in the video, and I'll toss the audio in. So when Catherine says that it took her up until the 21st mile to then be able to get back into a regular routine, she was so angry and so thrown off that the next, you know, 16, 17 miles.
Right.
Essentially, we're all a blur because she was so angry. Right. It took that long for her to come down, which is a crazy amount of time.
You know, I'm so full of confidence now. But at that moment, being I just turned 20, and then I got really angry myself, which was great, because I turned to my coach and I said, "I'm going to finish this race on my hands and my knees if I have to, because if I don't finish this race, nobody's going to believe women can do it. And they're not going to believe women deserve to be here. I have to finish this race."
Right. No, but you can imagine, I mean, what that would have been like, right? It just totally. Yeah. I can't imagine what that would have been like, to be honest, but it's just, it just seems absurd.
I mean, I got cut off on the way here and I was so angry I wanted to punch a hole through a wall. So I can sort of understand. I can get behind it a little bit.
There you go. So after the cross block incident, the press had stayed with Catherine and her crew. And they were asking her questions like, what are you doing this for? All that sort of thing. And Tom was frustrated that he hit an official. And Catherine thought about quitting the race, but she didn't want Jock to defeat her. Mm-hmm. But she didn't want this official to do this. So the next 20 miles, as you spoke about, were pretty difficult to run. Yeah. There's no rhythm. They're just out of sorts. You know, there's a lot going on in her mind. And after the embarrassment of the incident and losing a glove in the process, she was feeling the side effects. Because believe it or not, she explains, she got really, really cold really fast because with a wet hand in this weather, it just kind of just builds on it, right? And as I said, the press was still there and they were peppering her with questions like, why did you do it? Like, why are you running this race? You know, which seems ridiculous. And are you a suffragette? Again, pretty crazy.
When a feminist looks in the mirror, do they see an equal woman or a better woman?
They quite often, like all of us, look for what they want to see and they look for what they hope to see.
You see yourself back to front, don't you, in a mirror? But not upside down. Why is that?
Well, hopefully, because that's the way that mirrors are designed.
What powers a mirror? Sorry, you're not the mirrors expert, are you?
They did finish the race. You know, they got through it, and we're happy to be finished, I think, at that point. And she had some major blisters on her feet and everything, so she had to get checked up by officials, and they had to bandage her up, and she couldn't get her shoes back on, but she had finished it, and that was the main goal. Didn't matter how long it took. She just wanted to finish the race at that point. After that, you know, they left the race. They went and had a steak dinner. They showered up, and the group decided to start their drive back to Syracuse at 10 o'clock the same day, 10 p.m. This is a tight window to fit this in.
Yeah.
So they're heading back to Syracuse from Boston at 10 p.m. About 1 a.m. at a rest stop near Albany on the New York State Thruway, they stopped for gas and coffee. And Catherine noticed the newspapers that were the next day's newspapers, and all over the front and back covers were their photos, four of them. Mm-hmm. Everywhere from page to page, it was girl running, girl being attacked, girl being saved by boyfriend. A happy bedraggled girl in bloody socks at finish. So it pretty much was all about her, which just seemed absurd. And after that, you know, they drive back, and needless to say that no one, you know, they were concerned about falling asleep on the way home. Well, that once they were basically front page news.
Yeah.
No one was falling asleep on the way home then.
So I'm doing a little look around here. I want to say, what is this? We're going to get to 1972 before the Boston Marathon actually gets their own women's version of the race. Yeah, is that the year we're looking at here? So, God.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the story of the first woman to run the Boston Marathon who is registered, though probably not legally registered.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you're right. Then after this, the AAU banned women from competing in races against men as a result of this run. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until 1972 until the Boston Marathon established an official women's race.
That feels like the Amateur Athletic Union being like, hey, you just embarrassed us. We're mad.
Exactly.
Hey, yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
I just want to throw this out here because it is 72, and I think it ties in nicely with what we were talking about earlier with the Title IX thing. So in the same year, 1972, here's your Sam's Mr. Familaro's History Corner. So in 1972, President Nixon signed Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972 into law. This particular comprehensive federal law removed many barriers that once prevented people on the basis of sex from participating in educational opportunities and careers of their choice. Now, Title IX does apply to many things, not simply sports, but once Title IX was implied or put in place, it did have a major impact on collegiate sports. Again, educational opportunities count under that guidelines, in particular, college, collegiate, varsity, intramural sports. I mean, as is tradition with anything that is a sort of progressive change in society. You almost immediately were opened up to public scrutiny. In July 21st, 1975, Congress reviewed and approved the Title IX regulations and rejected a variety of resolutions that tried to disprove the athletics regulation, four of them over the course of 1975 alone, in June 5th from Jesse Helms, and June 17th from Representative James G. Martin, and July 16th from Senators Paul Laxalt, Carl T. Curtis, and Paul Finan. And then in July of 21st of 75, Senator Jesse Helms back again. So two from Jesse Helms in 1975. He couldn't get enough.
And he sometimes clashed with colleagues, as when a group of congresswomen tried to crash one of his hearings.
Mr. Chairman, we would like you to meet with us.
You know you are out of order, and I would not be discourteous to you where you work. Now, you please be a lady.
Title IX, of course, remains a huge part of education in our law system today. Matter of fact, in June of 2022, the 50th year anniversary of Title IX was celebrated, and it was released by the U.S. Department of Education, sort of a public comment for proposed changes or regulations. That's sort of been going on for the last 2 years. I mean, again, if you have a daughter, a cousin, a niece, nephew, a child who participates, a female child who participates in women's sports in any time between now and 1972, you have Title IX to thank for their sport being supported, even as minimally as women's sports are compared to men's sports in colleges across the United States today anyway, even with this in place. So,
absolutely. No, I just... You know, this obviously predates us being alive, right?
Certainly. 1960s. Yeah.
I was, you know, I Title IX and myself came into existence the same year. So 1972. Yeah. But it just seems so bizarre to me that that women's athletics, I mean, for all intents and purposes, didn't really exist in much of a way. I mean, until 1972 when Title IX came into play, right?
I'm trying not to be controversial here. I'm trying to be as straight-laced as I can as a history teacher on this. So I'll say this gently. You can look at the history of when the United States allows women to do things, not just participate in sports, but do anything in comparison to men, regardless of race, religion, or creed. We just treat women very differently than we treat men in this country, and have going back to since the time of our founding. It's just something that's happened. It happens all the time, and it has constantly through history. Women got to vote considerably later than almost any other group of people, fighting for way longer. At the end of World War One, everyone goes to war. The women come back, take the jobs, and all the men are gone. The men come back. Women don't get the chance anymore. Same thing happens at the end of World War II. Women in the workplace come back. Wait, we don't want to go back home yet. It's a slow burn. And as a history teacher, I've seen lots and lots of examples of it being a slow burn. And again, you know, this is 1967. You know, up until this point, there's really not. I looked a little bit. There's not a ton of like female first that even happened before this. The oldest thing I could find was 1938. Babe Zaharias is the first woman to play in a PGA Tour event. That's like the first thing I could find anywhere. Right.
Wow. I just find it absurd to me that's the case, but it was. And thankfully we've come a long way since then.
And I do think it's telling that if you look at from June of 1972, from the passing of Title IX, the number of women's first, females first in sports shoots up dramatically every single year. I do think that it has made a change in how we perceive sports and how people, again, I think sports is important, especially with the collegiate level, because, you know, sports sometimes can allow you to get in the door for a place that you couldn't get into. So sports is sometimes the key to unlock something else, because certainly not every athlete who goes to college on athletic scholarship is going professional, right?
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just the doorway. It's just the path. You know?
Yeah. So there are a few things that came out like the aftermath from here. We talked about Title IX. We talked about they banned women from competing after this.
Yes.
Until 1972. But down the road, Catherine and Tom Miller actually went on to get married in 1968. Mm-hmm. They mm-hmm. did happen to divorce in 1973. So it That's was right. a short marriage. Roberta Gibb, who I spoke about earlier, who snuck mm-hmm. into the race in 1966, she is now recognized by the Boston Athletic Association as the pre-sanctioned era women's winner in That's 1966, right. 1967, which is when this story took place. So she must have been there.
Oh, yeah.
And 1968. So, which is kind of cool. And also, Catherine Switzer went on to win the 1974 New York City Marathon.
Yeah.
And take second in the 1975 Boston Marathon, legitimately.
Mm-hmm.
And Catherine Switzer eventually made amends with Jock Semple after he changed his mind with regards to women in sports. And the two became close friends.
Really?
And she last, yeah. Well, I'll say yes with a caveat that this is Wikipedia.
Of course,
so you
yes.
Just
no.
Never know for sure. But the two became close friends, and she last visited him shortly before he died in 1988. So, which I hope that's real, because that'd be a fun way to end that little story.
I hope so. If not, I'm going to assume that for the rest of my brain, and that's how the story
exactly.
ends. Yeah.
Exactly. But if anybody wants to see more about this, as you said, Sam, you could find a lot about this. Catherine is still, you know, she tells this story better than anyone because it's her own story.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. Right?
And she has her own website. She's written a book. There's some things on YouTube you can find with her. So it's a pretty interesting story.
It wasn't until about midnight when we were driving back from Boston to Syracuse University and we stopped on the thruway to get an ice cream and some coffee. Did we see the newspapers and the covered front and back of all the different editions with the pictures. I realized that now this was very, very important, and this was going to change my life, and it was probably going to change women's sports.
So, Randall, before we close up here, I'm going to try and frame this in the right way, because I could, and I'm going to do this at the end so that if it comes out poorly, I'll just cut it and we'll never play it.
Yeah, exactly. So
one of the things I hear a lot from men in terms of talking about women's sports is that they find that women's sports are not the same. I don't watch women's soccer or tennis or whatever, because it's not the same. And I was trying to think about in my mind what sports, because I got me thinking about it with this okay. Boston Marathon, like what sports feel like they have very minimal, if any, drop off between when you watch men compete in it and women compete in it. And the very first thing that came to my head, of course, is soccer. I feel like there is almost okay. no difference between watching men's soccer and women's soccer when you're watching it on television, except that the U.S. men's team is bad and the U.S. women's national team is very good, right?
Right.
Rosa Val, lovely run, great goal, brilliant goal. Rosa Val might have won the World Cup for the United States with a fantastic goal. The United States 2, the Netherlands 0. For the fourth time, the United States of America are crowned champions of the world, and for the very first time, they've done it.
I feel like tennis. I feel like tennis is actually
tennis for sure.
Yeah, that almost is more interesting to watch when it's women, because I find the game is a little more volley heavy, whereas the men's game tends to be a bit more ace heavy, which is less exciting for me to watch.
Yeah, no, I would. My first inclination would be tennis, because I remember watching a lot of women's tennis growing up, because there were great personalities.
Yeah, Billie Jean.
Well, and you've got Martina, and then you've got Chris Everett, and then you've got Steffi Graf, and you've got Monica Seles, and there's a whole list, right, of all these women. And then, of course, you get to the Venus sisters. I'm sorry, the Williams sisters, Venus and Serena. So definitely tennis would be top of my list.
Golf, too, when we were growing up, is pretty much similar.
Right.
The one that I hear most people complain about when I was growing up, at least, was basketball. That women's basketball does not look like men's basketball. But my caveat for this, and this is where I will say, in the 90s, And in the early 2000s, maybe that was the case. Because when I was a kid watching basketball, what was the thing you wanted was big dunks, big strong dunks. We're Sean Kemp.
That's right.
And I remember as a little kid being like, well, the women don't dunk. Well, nowadays, basketball is mostly three-point shooting.
Exactly.
So I've really enjoyed watching. Actually, this is going to sound very strange. I enjoy a lot of like women's college basketball because there's a ton of excellent three-point shooting. And I think that as the basketball changes, that also, that sort of argument has sort of fallen by the wayside. And I think as you move farther on, you'll see less and less sort of difference between this. I thought that was handled pretty democratically. Yes. I don't have to cut that. That was good.
Yeah, no, I agree. You're right about the basketball. The changes in the games have really made them much more similar. So
I tried to stay away from any sort of wrestling references, although I could also say that women's wrestling in 2023 is the best it's ever been in terms of actual athleticism. That is not a joke. Like when we were growing up, there were women's wrestling was obscene. It was obscene. It was essentially like softcore pornography. And now today it's treated like actual competitive sport. So, I mean, again, not a real sport, but again, even that perception but from when I was growing up.
You're right. It's athletic nonetheless.
This is exactly why this kind of match is why our divas, our women, are co-main eventing tonight.
Bailey trying to overcome the lack of self-confidence she's had, trying to overcome an injured hand. Bailey to belly! Bailey to belly! Bailey to belly for the title! Hook of the leg and kick out!
Randall, this was great. I appreciate you. This was a great conversation point. I like talking about this. This is one I don't know that I knew beforehand. Sometimes when we do these, I have a little inkling beforehand. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I got to pretend I don't know about this. But this was fun. This was like a new, exciting one that I didn't have to feign any surprise. But
Yeah. No, I think it's a fun story. So I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I wish I could have gone on a more casual basis. We were really through doing a lot of stuff throughout the day. But really cool. And it is a great sports city today, as I was saying earlier.
It is.
It's all over the place. It really feels different than New York. Like, New York is such a different animal. It's the people feel different. The pace is so different than living in New York. Yeah. The structure, it looks different. Yeah.
It does. Yeah, no, I've been to Boston a few times and I absolutely love it because of the history. It's so interesting. And I've been fortunate enough to go to a couple of Red Sox games at Fenway, which is a totally amazing experience. I've seen the Yankees Red Sox, which obviously makes it even more heightened, right? That was late 90s. So that was the battle royale between the two teams.
Do you think that's peaked, by the way? We were talking about this, me and my Red Sox fan. We think that the Yankees Red Sox rivalry has kind of crested a little bit because both teams never win anything anymore.
Yeah, I think you're probably right that it's kind of crested. I'm sure if, you know, because it was before the late 90s, early 2000s, right? It was
historical.
Late 70s was the most recent uptick before then. So it'll come back though. I mean, if those two teams are both good, like playoff caliber where they're battling, the rivalry will be reignited.
It would heat up quite quickly. And I guess you're right. Like the Yankees really, I guess the rivalry was probably hot in the 70s, like 76, 77, 78, all that kind of time.
Yeah.
Then the Yankees stink in the 80s. And then the Red Sox kind of stink a little bit in the 90s. And then it's really only in the early 2000s when they're both kind of good. And that's when it really kicks up. I don't remember much of a Red Sox games in like 1997 or 98. That feels like later, 99, 2000, when those teams got really hot.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because thinking of when they won that World Series was what, 04? The Red Sox? So you're right. It was more in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, and that was probably about as hot as it ever got. Like, that was fun. That was good times.
It was a lot of fun.
So I wanted to try a new thing with you because we were talking about top sports cities. I actually decided to reach out to a third guest host. That's the OpenAI engine ChatGPT.
The Skynet funding bill is passed. The system goes online on August 4th, 1997.
Human decisions are removed from strategic defense. Skynet begins to learn at a geometric rate. It becomes self-aware at 2:14 a.m. Eastern Time, August 29th. In a panic, they try to pull the plug.
Skynet fights back.
Yes. It launches its missiles against the targets in Russia.
Why attack Russia? Aren't they offensive?
And I typed into ChatGPT, which again doesn't relate to any city or culture. Like, what are the top five sports cities in the United States? And this is what it said to me. All of my knowledge for sports is cut off as of September 2021. However, I will base my information before that. So at least it's telling me already.
Okay. Where,
yeah.
Okay.
So here's the ranking. It said number five is Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Despite being small, it is deep-rooted with sports culture. Steelers, Penguins, Pirates, known for their unwavering support. The Pittsburgh, okay. Pennsylvania area, number five.
Interesting.
Number four, the Los Angeles area, Los Angeles, California. Mm. Vast population, multiple sports teams, emerges a major sports hub. Dodgers, Angels, Lakers, Clippers, Rams, Chargers, Kings, sunny climate, prominent celebrity in Hollywood culture contributes to the appeal. So yeah, I'm telling you,
this okay. is
gonna, ChatGPT is going to destroy my job. I just want you all to know that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Number three, Chicago, Illinois, renowned for its sporting passion and dedicated fan base. Strong sports traditions, Michael Jordan, the Bulls, the Blackhawks, the White Sox. So they're happy with Chicago. Number two.
Yeah.
New York.
Okay.
We know what that means. We know what that means. Number one, Boston, Massachusetts is what ChatGPT has chosen
wow.
as the number one sports city in America.
And why did it choose? What was their little blurb on Boston?
Just essentially great success, numerous championship victories across multiple sports, always dominant in every era. These all feel right. I feel like you could have rotated all five of these in order and everyone would say, yeah, that's about right.
Do you think Pittsburgh's ahead of Philadelphia? That to me would be the one that I would question.
Pittsburgh ahead of Philadelphia. Well, here, let me try something here. I'm going to regenerate a response from our host and see if he says the same thing. I'm going to test it. Let's see.
There you go.
Oh, no, he's the same thing. Boston, okay. New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Philadelphia. No, he's committed. ChatGPT is very committed.
No, is it Philly or Pittsburgh? The second time there.
Philly.
You said Philly?
Oh, Philly. So this time it wavered. It went to Philly this time. Oh, yeah. My God. So there we go. See? Wow, it's wavering. See? It's not as smart as it says it is. All these AI programs. I still have a job. I'm still in here, baby.
You do. You do.
Yeah, so thanks for a quick appearance from our third host, ChatGPT, about sports cities.
Love it.
Yeah, I think, though, like, if I'll put it this way. If you and I and Kelly and some like-minded individuals went out and had a good time a couple days in Boston, we'd have a great time, I think. Just enjoying all the sights. A lot of cool stuff to do.
Absolutely.
I think you and I as history people would probably get more out of it than a lot of people who don't. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, and you didn't, you know, because last time we were there, we went up to Salem, Massachusetts,
yep. mm-hmm.
which is incredible. Yeah. There's so much to see and do. You were there for what, a day and a half?
So we went... This is why I'm a little punchy today. We we left at 4:05 in the morning. So I had to be there at like 4 in the morning to get everything ready. And then we got back at 2:30 in the morning. So
you were only there for not even 24 hours.
No. We were there for like, where I spent like 13 hours, 14 hours in the city doing stuff all together. Yeah. And then 8 hours, however long it is in the car. So I'm obviously very clearly like punch drunk and sweaty today.
Yes.
But no, it's like we rushed a lot through a lot of it. You really could have slow rolled it. I didn't have too many other sports stories. I did want to mention one thing, though, before we move on to anything else. Did you see that my hometown hero, Carmelo Anthony, retired this week? Carmelo Anthony retired from basketball. Funny story. I thought he had already retired.
Yeah, I was going to say. it's official, I guess.
He officially announced his retirement. Carmelo Anthony.
You guys can stop sending me the contracts. I'm not going.
Yeah, I'm done. I think I think they had already stopped sending him the contracts. And he was like, okay, I think it's time.
Okay. I guess
you got to get a head start on that Hall of Fame thing. You got 5 years to wait it out before.
Yeah, exactly.
Hall of Fame. Yeah. Let me ask you this. I'm obviously biased. I'm a huge Syracuse fan. I have a Syracuse Orangemen tattoo. I love the Knicks, and he has that weird connection to the Knicks. As somebody who's not like a New York-based guy, what are your thoughts on Carmelo Anthony, the basketball player? Where would you put him?
I would – where would I put him? I don't know what that means, Sam. But so, I would say –
because my initial thought when I talked to one of my students is he reminds me a little bit of a Karl Malone type with the way he played, like this offensive juggernaut type character, but not really like couldn't ever really like put it over the hump. Wasn't quite the best guy when he ever played.
Right.
But like he's probably not as good as Malone, I would guess, in history, in historical eyes. Right.
I don't think so. I think that he was an elite level scorer, right?
Elite level scorer.
Elite level scorer. And, you know, I didn't really follow Carmelo's NBA career that closely because he was in Denver, right, to start.
Denver,
and he went to the Knicks, and you know how I feel about the Knicks. So I don't follow any Knicks, but he's one of those guys who never could win a championship. So, as the man, so I think
Then it gets into a question of like, is championships the defining thing? We always talk about this like a common sports question. Like in New York, I wonder what his legacy will be because he's beloved because he's sort of like a hometown guy, quote unquote. But there's like a lot of guys in New York who dogged on Carmelo his whole career for not being able to win. He wasn't like always beloved when he was playing necessarily. Yeah. He really was like, I mean, I watched him play live a couple times, and when I saw him play, he scored like 30 points that night, and it was exhilarating. He was just going off.
Sure.
So I always have that sort of thing, and the Syracuse thing is always great for me. I think when you're upstate New York, there's a lot of like Syracuse, Carmelo will always have carte blanche to do whatever he wants in our mind. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I it's interesting that you say that about Carmelo because I guess I didn't put two and two together because I might have been on Twitter or something. I saw, do you think the Knicks should retire his number? And I didn't really know why they said that, but now I guess it's because he's officially retired.
He's officially retired, yeah.
But do you think the Knicks should retire his number?
Well, yes, because we don't really hang too many banners up these days. We got to do something to keep people coming in the door. I guess my question is more because I was thinking about this with LeBron. I guess you can sort of make the same question. When both these guys inevitably go in the Hall of Fame, neither of these guys are going in as Knicks and Lakers. They're probably going in as Denver Nugget and Cleveland Cavalier, right?
Does the NBA do it that way?
I don't know how the NBA decides. Like,
but let's, for argument's sake, right?
Yeah, for argument's sake, like Carmelo probably spent more. He probably didn't spend more time in Denver. He probably did spend more time in New York. I'd have to look it up. Let me look it up right now while I'm chatting.
Yeah. No, that's a good question. I guess, you know, New York is just a media capital. So I kind of think of Carmelo as a Knick more than a Nugget.
Well, I certainly do.
Yeah, I know you do. And that could be recency bias, right? Because that's where he was. He didn't end up there, right? He
petered out toward the end. All right. So here we go. Yeah. Let me give you a little head date here. So 8 seasons with Denver, 7 seasons with New York, 2 seasons pretty with close. Portland, 1 with Oklahoma City, 1 with the Lakers, 1 with Houston, sort of danced around at the
end. Yeah, that's what I thought.
So you could, if you're Carmelo, you could probably choose Denver or New York, and people would probably accept it either way. Yeah. I think, right?
Yeah.
With LeBron, it just feels like Cleveland would make the most sense. Although he doesn't seem like he would go in as a Laker. It's only been like what? He's been all over the place. Been
5 seasons now with the Lakers, isn't
it?
4 or 5.
I mean, like, 11 seasons in Cleveland altogether for LeBron. Yeah. So,
no, I think it would be Cleveland, and because he's from Akron, I think he would.
Yeah.
If there were a choice he could make, I do think he would choose Cleveland.
It would make more sense. I mean, I'm sort of curious to what the NBA is going to look like in like 5-10 years when all the oldest like superstars have sort of transitioned out, when it's just like the Jaylen Browns and Jason Tatum's of the world, like the younger guys who are coming up. Like, I'm so curious to see who's going to establish themselves. Is it just going to be like the Giannis and Joel Embiid league and Jokic?
Probably. I mean, those would be the leaders. I mean, there's a lot of good talent though, young talent. But yeah, I know what you mean. There's nobody like LeBron, who was clearly the best player for so long. I think now you could argue, you know, between those three you just mentioned, Giannis, Jokic, Embiid, and then you've got Tatum right behind him. It's interesting.
I just kind of want to see what happens after the season is over with all the nonsense that's going on. Brandon, as you can tell, I'm getting a little punchy here. What's been on your sports plate? I feel like I've been throwing a lot of my sports stuff with you. What's been on your mind sports wise before we close up here today?
Well, I've been really, you know, the Celtics, you were in Boston. Now they're making it a series where it looked like they were buried.
Yeah.
And that's definitely intriguing to me. I'm just starting to pay attention to baseball more and more as we get closer to Memorial Day. Kind of, you can assess what your team's all about, which isn't making me too happy looking at the Cubs. But
yeah, I haven't spent much time with the Cubs. Where are the Cubs right now? I haven't even looked.
Yeah, no, they started out pretty well for them, but they've come back down to earth. So, you know, they're right there near the cellar.
So they're 22-27, and I hate to break it to you, as I'm looking this up, they are currently getting beaten 7-0 by the Cincinnati Reds.
You know, the juggernaut Cincinnati Reds. that makes me real happy. I think I'm excited to turn the page to baseball. And honestly, I know we talk about the NFL schedule release? Did we talk about that?
No, we did not.
Okay. Because some people, this is like a huge day for them. Mm-hmm. The schedule release. I don't necessarily find it to be all that exciting, right?
No, it doesn't mean much to me. Yeah.
But I tell you what, once it was released and I take a look at it, I'm kind of getting excited about football.
Well, you know what it was? It's funny you say that, because I was on the treadmill and they were showing the Bills schedule on one of the things.
Yeah.
I saw that the first game was a Monday night game, and I was like, hey. Oh, all right. Are we already thinking about how Josh Allen's going to disappoint me the first game of the season on national television? When Jason Tatum was getting all this beef a couple weeks ago for the 3-0.
Right.
I heard a lot of this going around, this like, oh, Jason Tatum and Josh Allen are the same guy. They can't do it in the playoffs. And I was just like, I don't like this. I don't like this. I don't like people talking about it. Where did this come from? Is it just to make me feel bad? Is it just to make me upset?
Why did
you bring Josh Allen into this? Why are you pulling him on a he's like chilling. He's playing golf somewhere. I wanted to mention one last thing too, because we're going to run out of time in a minute. I do think by the time I get this out, by the time people hear this, if you're listening to it on Saturday, tomorrow is one of my favorite days of the entire year, even though the entire season is pretty much already decided. It is the last day of the Premier League season. All the games will be played at the same time, so we'll find out who will get relegated, because that's pretty much all there is to find out now. Liverpool already kind of blew their chance to get in the Champions League yesterday. Are you sad as a Liverpool fan that they will only be in Europa League? I'm actually kind of up and down about the whole thing. So what are your thoughts? Do you have any feelings about not making Champions League?
Yeah, no, I think that I'm disappointed that they didn't make it, for sure. Yeah, I think that's all they had to play for at this point, right? This season. That was it. But you know, sometimes when you get knocked down a peg, it makes you reassess and get stronger.
I mean, I saw somebody say this, and because I was a little mad about it on Thursday when I was driving home in the bus and looking at the scores. I'm like, God damn it.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things where it's like, when I started watching Liverpool, we were like desperate. There's like this famous John Oliver clip, and if I can find it, I'll plug it in over here. But
every moment. I'll tell you, you said the following.
Yeah.
I've given up expecting or needing to win the league as my days on this earth become shorter. I don't need trophies. This is like John Berryman talking about football.
That was bleak, wasn't it? That was a bleak time of my life.
I don't need top four finishes. I just need some nice passing sequences. 15 minutes coveting the ball. Is that too much to ask?
Yep.
In this Jordan Ibe,
It's just him going like, I just want to watch them play good football. There was a time when Liverpool was so bad that you were just like, I just want to see them string like seven passes together. And they've made the Champions League for the past six seasons or whatever it is in a row. Yeah, maybe they did get a little complacent. Maybe it's time to like clean things up a little bit. I'm not quite as depressed as I could be. I will be sort of depressed if Everton gets relegated, because then my other Premier League buddy is going to be really disappointed and he's not going to want to watch.
Right.
Yeah. Like he's not going to.
You're not in this league, are you?
I got to be honest. I'm sort of in like a weird spot with this as a Liverpool fan. I kind of root for Everton. I'm always interested. I like really? To have an. Yeah, because I like to have an underdog team. I like to have a team that like isn't like in the not well now Liverpool can go back to being the underdog team because they stink again. But I like having a rooting interest in a team who isn't like the best team. I always have. Like it's years of being a Bills fan. I'm always interested in like the process. And there's something about this Everton team, you know, I've been watching them for like 10 years sort of by accident because Justin's a Everton fan. And they're such a hard watch that now I just kind of want them to survive for his sake. I'm like, oh man, he's going to be so disappointed if this, because they're going to, if they get relegated this weekend, it's going to be an absolute travesty. That team might never come back. Like, I watched a video about this. I'll find it on YouTube about like what would happen to them financially with all the stuff that's tied up with their new stadium.
Really?
They're already like in crazy financial debt as it is, being the team who's like ranked 17th. It would be an absolute shambles nightmare. They would have to sell almost all their players. They would have to like refinance their new stadium. Mad people's jobs would get lost. It would be a tragedy. I mean, unless you're a real masochist to love watching people. You know what I mean, it's gonna happen to all these teams. Like, I feel bad saying it, but like, you know, it could happen to Leicester. It could happen. The Leeds and Leicester are pretty much doing the same thing. So one of these teams is gonna be in a lot of trouble with the way this whole thing works. And that'll be the exciting watch tomorrow. I mean, I guess. There's no Man City, another year of Man City.
I know. Man City.
All right. Randall, I'm going to take a 45-minute break to drink some coffee, and then I'm going to start editing this episode. And we will be done tonight. But this has been fun. And then next week, we get into my guy, Drazen Petrovic. We got three more episodes this season.
Yeah, and then, three more.
Beautiful. And then we'll be on vacation and we can enjoy the Adirondacks. That's coming up soon, too. I'm starting to think about it.
Looking forward to it. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Dude, we got like 13 days of school left. I know that's like a terrible thing. Like, the teacher's are already like counting it down, but like,
oh, yeah,
you can feel it. It's coming. It's right there. All right, brother. I will talk to you soon. Take care.
All right, Sam. Bye.